the end of our last lesson, the 7 years of abundant crops and livestock had passed, and the great seven-year famine of Pharaoh's dream had begun. Joseph was now in charge of Egypt, and his food program, the food program was his, and he was second in command of the nation with only Pharaoh above him. Joseph was one of the most powerful men on earth at this time in history. Now, the famine of Genesis 41 that we read about last week was caused by low rainfall, a drought. This drought that apparently affected northern Africa, where Egypt lay, also affected much of the Middle East. I want to talk a little bit about the geography because it helps us to understand the overall situation of this section of the Torah. It explains why many things happened in the way they did. First of all, the regional designations of Egypt are virtually backwards from what we would think normally. Egypt is always spoken of as Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. Interestingly, though, Upper Egypt is to the south and Lower Egypt is to the north. This is because the Nile River flows from south to north. It flows from Upper Egypt to Lower Egypt. And this helps explain just why Egypt's called, why Southern Egypt is called Upper. Now, obviously, water flows downhill. If you know otherwise, I'd like to know about it. And as it turns out, the southern end of Egypt is a slightly higher elevation than the northern end. Therefore, as anyone knows that a river flows from up to down, the southern end of the river is called upper and the northern end lower. Now, the southern end of the Nile, Upper Egypt, is where the Nile begins. And there are two enormous geographical basins where the rainfall flows and where the water from that rainfall naturally funnels into the Nile to fill it. From one basin flows what is called the White Nile. From the other basin, the Blue Nile. And around the city of Khartoum, the White Nile and the Blue Nile come together and it forms the Great Nile River, which we typically just call the Nile River. Now, the Great Nile then flows up, to our way of thinking, up north, towards the Mediterranean Sea. And as it approaches the land of Goshen in Lower Egypt, which is up, it encounters what is called the Delta region. And the river dissipates into a number of natural fingers that all eventually find their way to the sea. And even though the Delta region, as is most of the Lower Egypt, a virtually rainless desert, due to the abundant waters of the Nile and the marshlands that are created by all those fingers spreading out in the land of the Goshen area, allowing the water to flow across lands a lot like the Florida Everglades, the area is fertile. It's great for growing crops and for grazing animals. The bottom line here is that the only thing that makes Egypt inhabitable is the Nile. And if you've ever been there, and I have, you learn that pretty quickly. And the only thing that creates the Nile is rainfall from those two great basins far to the south in what's called Upper Egypt. Now, even though the Egyptians very early on began digging canals to channel water from the Nile to water their crops, it was the annual rising and falling of the water levels of the Nile that determined whether there would be feast or famine. It's crucial that the Nile overflows its banks during the three summer months, an overflow caused by monsoon-type rains that occur far to the south in the two southern river basins that form the headwaters of the Nile. The overflow not only waters the land, but it brings silt, rich in nutrients necessary to grow crops all along the Nile. But it takes only a few inches of rainfall deficit in but one of the two great southern basins to destroy this delicate balance and prevent sufficient water flow to cause the necessary downstream flooding. So, as pertains to our story, it's not that the Nile dried up in Joseph's time, nor that people didn't have sufficient water to drink. It's simply that for a several-year period, the Nile did not overflow, and the marshlands of the delta receded, and therefore sufficient crops were not produced to feed all the citizens of Egypt. To be clear, all food production did not cease, but it was dramatically reduced, and there simply was not enough to sustain the people. Just so we understand, though, the supernatural nature of this widespread famine, the weather systems that govern rainfall in southern Egypt and those that govern rainfall in the Middle East are totally separate. That very low rainfall occurred for several years in southern Egypt. During the same time there was a drought for several years over in Canaan was a God thing. That does not normally occur. Now, one of the reasons that Egypt and the people of Canaan knew each other so well and had since time immemorial established trade was because usually when there was a crop failure in Egypt due to low levels of the Nile, Egypt could count on going up to Canaan to get extra food and vice versa. But this time is different. Had God not given Pharaoh this prophetic dream and then given him Joseph to interpret it, there would have been widespread death in both Egypt and Canaan because of low food supplies in both lands. But God warned Egypt, and Egypt prepared because they were able to prepare. God first gave them supernatural abundance so that they could have a hefty surplus for seven straight years. Joseph planned. He used this so that he could build up enormous stores of grain for the coming 7 years. The bad years. Later, upon the onset of the drought, Egypt, partly from a sense of compassion, but primarily from a sense of self-interest, made food available from its warehouses to people of other nations. This was not welfare. The price for those stored grains was very high. We see from the upcoming story of Genesis 42 and 43, that several bags of silver was required to buy food from Egypt for the clan of Jacob. Food would not normally have required a sum of money that would be spoken of in terms of bags of silver. Rather, Egypt was going to make a huge profit on its adept handling of this extended and extensive food crisis. But make no mistake, these high prices were not only for foreigners. Egyptian citizens also were required to purchase their food from Pharaoh, or better, from Joseph. A supplement, to be sure, usually not their sole source of food. But for those who were poorer and did not have access to other more commercially available food sources, this famine wound up costing hundreds of thousands of Egyptians, possibly a million or more, their liberty. Because as these lower class Egyptians ran out of money to buy food, they had no choice but to sell themselves and their families into bond servitude to the government, to Pharaoh, in exchange for food grain. But from their standpoint, it was this semi-foreigner, Joseph, he was to blame for this travesty and humiliation. Because Joseph was the front man, wasn't he? He was the visible symbol for the entire food program. It was hid. That Pharaoh was pretty smart. So Joseph would get both credit and blame. This was not something Egypt was soon going to forget. After Joseph's death, after a long period of social upheaval, the Egyptians eventually would blame Joseph's kin, the tribes of Israel, for their condition now. This would eventually lead to the Egyptians turning the tables on Israel. The peasant Egyptians, who had lost their liberty, would now enslave the more well-to-do and free Israelites, beginning a cycle of persecution of the Hebrew people in foreign lands that we read of throughout the Bible. And we've witnessed ourselves in the last century. And we're going to continue to witness it until Messiah comes. So, open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 42. Genesis chapter 42. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, that is going to be on page 47. Genesis chapter 42. Now Yaakov, it's Jacob, saw that there was grain in Egypt, so Jacob said to his sons, "Why are you just staring at each other? Look," he said, "I've heard there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we can stay alive and not die." Thus Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt, except for Benjamin, Joseph's brother. Yaakov did not send him with his brothers because he was afraid something might happen to him. Now the sons of Israel came to buy along with the others that came, since the famine extended to the land of Canaan. Joseph was governor over the land. It was he who sold to all the people in the land. Now when Joseph's brothers came and prostrated themselves before him on the ground, Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted towards them as if he were a stranger, and he spoke harshly with them. And he asked them, "Where are you from?" They answered, "From the land of Canaan, to buy food." So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they didn't recognize him. Now, remembering the dreams he had had about them, Joseph said to them, "You're spies. You've come to spot our country's weaknesses." "No, my lord," they replied, "your servants have come just to buy food. We're all the sons of one man. We're upright men. Your servants aren't spies." "No," he said to them, "you've come out to spy out our country's weaknesses." They said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. The youngest stayed with our father, and another one is gone." "Just as I said," replied Joseph, "you're spies. And here's how you can prove you're not lying. As Pharaoh lives, you will not leave here unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, let him bring your brother. Meanwhile, you will be kept in custody. This will prove whether there's any truth in what you say. Otherwise, as Pharaoh lives, you are certainly spies." Then he put all of them together in prison for 3 days. Well, on the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do what I say and stay alive, for I fear God. If you are upright men, let one of your brothers remain incarcerated in the prison you're being kept in while you go and carry grain back to relieve the famine in your homes. But bring your youngest brother to me. In this way, your statements will be verified and you won't die." So they did it. They said to each other, "We are in fact guilty concerning our brother. He was in distress and he pleaded with us. We saw it, we wouldn't listen. That's why this distress has come upon us now." And Reuben answered them, "Didn't I tell you? Don't wrong the boy. You wouldn't hear of it. Now comes the reckoning for his blood." They had no idea that Joseph understood them, since an interpreter was translating for them. Joseph turned away from them and he wept. And then he returned and spoke to them. He took Shimon from among them and put him in prison before their eyes. And next he ordered that the containers be filled with grain, that every man's money be put back into his pack, and that they be given provisions for their journey. When these things had been done for them, they loaded their grain on their donkeys and departed. But at camp that night, as one of them opened his pack to give fodder to his donkey, he noticed his money. There it was, just inside his pack. And he said to his brothers, "My money's been restored. It's right there and right in my pack." And at that, their hearts sank and they turned, trembling to one another. "What is this that God has done to us?" They returned to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan and told him all that had happened to them. The man, the lord of the land, spoke harshly with us. He took us for spies in his country, and we said to him, "No, we're upright men, we're not spies. We're 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is gone, and the youngest stayed with our father in the land of Canaan. But the man, the lord of the land, said to us, 'Here is how I'll know that you are upright men. Leave one of your brothers with me. Take grain to relieve the famine in your homes and go on your way, but bring your youngest brother to me. By this I'll know you aren't spies but are upright men, and then I'll return your brother to you, and you will do business in the land.' Next, as they emptied their packs, there was each man's bag of money in his pack. And when they and their father saw their bags of money, they became afraid. Yaakov, their father, said to them, 'You have robbed me of my children. Joseph is gone. Shimon is gone. Now you're taking Benjamin away. It all falls on me.' And Reuben said to his father, 'If I don't bring him back to you, you can kill my own two sons. Put him in my care. I will return him to you.' But he replied, 'My son will not go down with you. His brother is dead, and he alone is left. If anything were to happen to him while traveling with you, you would bring my gray hair down to Sheol with grief.'" You know, if we can but grasp that Israel was the tool that God would use to bring about his divine purposes from this point forward in history until time comes to an end sometime, I think, in the near future, then perhaps we can begin to comprehend the significance of what's about to happen in this biblical narrative. We have now moved from Egypt and Joseph back up to Canaan and Jacob. The great famine having now affected an enormous area, Jacob's clan's in a bad way. And the first verse of this chapter, we see Jacob, Israel, in a pretty sarcastic mood because he looks at his sons and says, "Why are you staring at each other?" In other words, you know we're in dire straits. You know there's grain available in Egypt, so why are you all sitting here waiting for somebody else to do something? Let's remember, he wasn't speaking to children. These men were all middle-aged and beyond, most of them with their own families and children by now. Now, while I wish I could find some good and lovely things to say about Jacob's sons, the 12 tribes of Israel, the Bible didn't offer much about their character that's admirable at this point. God didn't choose Israel because they were great men. He chose them because he's a great God. And he uses ordinary people to carry out his will. And by the way, we're not told to stand with Israel because they're an especially good or an extraordinary or a sympathetic race, which they're not. We're to stand with them because that's what God has instructed all the people of this planet to do, with dire consequences for those who don't heed him. So brace yourselves, America. Our president has put his desire for a legacy of peace in the Middle East, regardless of the cost, ahead of his God-commanded concern for Israel. We're going to pay an awful price. Everybody that hears my voice and more, we're going to pay an awful price for this eventually. So Jacob, unable to wait any longer for these sons to do on their own volition what is right and what's necessary, orders all of them, except for Benjamin, to go down to Egypt to buy grain. Was Benjamin not old enough to go? Sure he was. But Benjamin had taken the place of Joseph in Jacob's heart, because Benjamin and Joseph were his two sons through the wife Jacob loved the most, Rachel, now deceased. He simply wasn't going to risk Benjamin after he's lost Joseph. And as the sons of Israel arrive in Egypt, they join in with many more tribes and people from other nations, all in need of being saved from starvation. And who is it they must go to for their salvation? Their brother, Joseph. Now, verse 6 makes it clear that it was common knowledge that it was this great vizier of Egypt who was now not going by the name Joseph, but by his Egyptian name that the Pharaoh had given him, Zaphnath-Paneah, that everyone must go to buy grain. And Joseph must certainly have had this immense organization to deal with the millions who needed food. Certainly it would have been rare for Joseph himself to deal directly with people who sought to buy grain. But of course, Joseph's brothers didn't recognize him. It's not just that 20 years had passed since they had last seen their little brother, and his boyish features had become manly. It's that he now looked very Egyptian. He was clean-shaven. Hebrews, by tradition, always wore beards. He wore his hair in Egyptian fashion and would have used certain cosmetics that Egyptian royalty typically applied to their faces. He also spoke Egyptian. And the mannerisms of that former tent-dwelling boy with all of his teenage gawkiness had been exchanged for the refined and the confident regal bearing that was now Joseph. But he recognized them immediately. And we can only imagine what must have flashed through his mind when he saw his brothers. Deep pain. From being so long ago torn away from his family at the hands of these same men. But in a nanosecond, it says in verse 9, that he remembered those dreams of his youth, of the 11 sheaves of grain bowing down to his, of the 11 stars and the moon and the sun paying homage to him. Must have been at that moment, with all this preparation so carefully guided by the invisible God, that those dreams that his brothers and his own father Jacob had chastised him for, they were true. Joseph realized for the first time that divine providence had been working all along. He now knew with certainty that God had allowed to happen what happened for a greater good. Yet some testing was needed now to see if his brothers had also been prepared. Now Joseph, knowing otherwise, accuses them of being spies. And the brothers are utterly taken aback by this, because this accusation doesn't even make any sense. It borders the irrational. But they're afraid, because they know that they are totally at this ruler's arbitrary mercy. Truth and justice didn't matter at this point. They knew it. For a ruler of Joseph's stature, he can decide matters summarily. He can order whatever punishment he deems appropriate. They're helpless. They're powerless to control their own fate, just as Joseph found himself helpless so long ago, lying at the bottom of a dry well, begging, crying for mercy that wasn't going to come from these same pitiless brothers, now standing before him, hat in hand. He questions them. He finds out his father's still alive, as is his little brother Benjamin. So he orders that one brother is to go back and bring the youngest brother, Benjamin, to prove their assertion they're not spies, that they were being truthful. But this wouldn't happen until all 10 of them were put into prison for 3 days. Now, of course, the reason behind Joseph's decision to jail them is he wants to separate his brothers from the myriads of Egyptian citizens and foreigners who come daily hoping to buy from Egypt's reserve grain supplies. He needed to deal with his family separately, not under the gaze of everybody else. At the end of 3 days, he gave a different order. 9 brothers are to return with the grain. They needed to feed their clan. One, Simeon, Shimon, was to remain in custody as surety for all the rest of them. And if they didn't bring Benjamin back, Simeon would forfeit his life. Or at least that was the implication. The brothers discussed their plight among themselves in front of Joseph, assuming he was an Egyptian and he wouldn't understand what they were speaking to each other in Hebrew. And Joseph kept up this ruse by using an interpreter as a go-between during his dealings with his brothers. And when he, what he heard, well, it made him weep. The guilt of over two decades overcame them, and they knew that this was their day of reckoning for what they had wrongly done to their little brother Joseph. But he also heard Reuben trying to absolve himself with apparently no disagreement as to his position of innocence. And Joseph must have believed him, because rather than keeping the all-important firstborn, Reuben, as his prisoner, Joseph ordered Simeon, the second son of Jacob, he was to be held hostage. Well, now Joseph really messes with their heads. He orders that the money that the brothers paid for the grain be hidden in the necks of their grain sacks. That very first night on their way back home, one of them went to get some grain for his donkey, and there was the money. Oh my gosh, what is going on here? And they quickly decided that God was giving them their just desserts. And one wonders what must have gone through their minds on that many-day journey back to face their father. Who would be the spokesman among them to tell their fragile father that not only had they come back one short in their number, but that now they were to take Benjamin, Jacob's most beloved child, back to Egypt with him, or Simeon would die, along with the rest of them when Pharaoh's men finally caught up with him. Jacob's reply is obvious. You've taken two of my children away from me, and now you want to take a third. Reuben then gives Jacob the guarantee he will bring Benjamin back. But if he fails, he says, Jacob, his father, can kill Reuben's two sons as punishment. Though we're not given Jacob's reply to this offer, one can only imagine the unbelieving look on Jacob's face. I mean, I really think his stunned reply would have gone something like, brilliant! Only you could figure out that after I've lost three sons, I should now kill my own grandchildren in retribution. Are you insane? More and more, we see the wisdom in Reuben being denied his firstborn birthright. Reuben's a politician. He's just a windbag. He's always making these grandiose, unwise statements and promises that are worthless. And they're designed to do little but elicit an emotional response, to get his way. In fact, we won't even hear from Reuben anymore. He is now set aside. And we will hear Judah's voice more than any other brother from this point forward. For the time being, though, Jacob is simply paralyzed. He can't fathom what he should do. All he knows is that should Benjamin be taken from him, he just couldn't survive it. He doesn't really trust these sons of his anymore, so he's not about to entrust Benjamin to them. Yet, how are they going to survive without more grain? How are they going to get Shimon back? Well, let's find out in Genesis chapter 43. Turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 43. It begins on page 48 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. But the famine was severe in the land. So when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought out of Egypt, their father said to them, go again, buy us a little food. Judah said to him, but the man expressly warned us, you will not see my face unless your brother's with you. If you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, you will not see my face unless your brother is with you. Israel, it's Jacob, said, why did you bring such trouble my way by telling the man you had another brother? They answered, the man kept questioning us about ourselves and about our kinsmen, and he asked, is your father still alive? Do you have another brother? We answered, according to the literal meaning of his questions, how were we to know he'd say, bring your brother down? And Judah said to his father Israel, Send the boy with me, and we will make preparations and leave, so that we may stay alive and not die, both we and you, also our little ones. I myself will guarantee his safety. You hold me responsible. If I fail to bring him to you and present him to your face, let me bear the blame forever. Except for our lengthy delay, we would have been there again by now. And their father Israel answered them, well, if that's how it is, do this. Take in your containers some of the land's best products and bring the man a gift. Some healing resin, a little honey, aromatic gum, opium, pistachio nuts, and almonds. Take twice the amount of money with you and return the money that came back with you in your packs. It could have been an oversight. Yes, and take your brother too, and get ready and go again to the man. May El Shaddai give you favor in the man's sight, so that he will release to you and your other brother as well as Benjamin. As for me, if I must lose my children, lose them I will. The men took that gift, and they took twice the money with them and Benjamin. Then they prepared and went down to Egypt and stood before Yosef. Now when Yosef saw Benjamin with them, he said to his household manager, take the men inside the house, kill the animals, and prepare the meat. These men will dine with me at noon. The man did as Yosef ordered and brought the men into Joseph's house. Upon being ushered inside Joseph's house, the men became fearful, and they said, it's because of the money that was returned on our packs the first time that we've been brought inside, so that he can use it as an excuse to attack us and take us as slaves and probably seize our donkeys too. So they approached the manager of Joseph's household and spoke to him at the entrance of the house. Please, my lord, the first time we indeed came down to buy food, but when we got to camp, we opened our packs, and there inside our packs was each man's money, the full amount. We've brought it back with us. Moreover, we have brought down other money to buy food. We have no idea who put money in our packs. Stop worrying, he replied. Don't be afraid. Your God and the God of your father put treasure in your packs. As for your money, I was the one who received it. Then he brought Shimon out to them. The man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he provided fodder for their donkeys, and then they got their gift ready for Joseph's arrival at noon, for they had heard that they were going to eat a meal there. And when Joseph arrived home, they went in the house and presented him with the gift they had brought with him, then prostrated themselves on the ground before him. He asked them how they were and inquired, is your father well? The old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive? And they answered, your servant, our father, is well. Yes, he is still alive, as they bowed in respect. He looked up and saw Benjamin, his brother, his mother's son, and said, is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? And he added, may God be good to you, my son. Then Joseph hurried out because his feelings towards his brothers were so strong he wanted to cry. He went into his bedroom and there he wept. And then he washed his face and came out, but he controlled himself as he gave the order to serve the meal. They served him by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians included at the meal by themselves. Egyptians don't eat with Hebrews, because that is aberrant to them. So they sat there facing him, the firstborn in the place of honor, the youngest in last place, and the men expressed their amazement to each other. Each was given his serving there in front of him, but Benjamin's portion was five times as large as any of theirs. So they drank and enjoyed themselves with him. Well, a little time passes. Famine hasn't let up yet. The grain supply purchased and brought back from Egypt is now exhausted. Apparently, the nine sons of Jacob, remember, Simeon is still back in Egypt, being held hostage, who had earlier sat in a depressed state and did nothing to try to save their clan from starvation, are once again, completely passive. So Jacob tells them, go back to Egypt and get more grain. Of course, Jacob is reminded by his sons, they can't go without Benjamin. And Jacob is still unconvinced to hand over Benjamin to these treacherous sons of his. Then Judah speaks. Judah, humbled by life, humiliated by his daughter-in-law Tamar's bold act, when Judah failed to respond to her plight appropriately, he now offers himself as the surety bond. for Benjamin. Now, one might ask, just exactly what penalty could Jacob extract from Judah should he fail on his mission to take Benjamin to Egypt and return him safely home? Well, as we discussed a while back, Judah almost certainly saw himself as the likely inheritor of the wealth and authority of the clan of Israel. He apparently knew Reuben was no longer going to receive the firstborn blessing because he defiled his father's bed. And of course, Jacob's second and third sons were the ones who led the raid of revenge upon Shechem, killing every male and then leading the plundering of the remaining inhabitants. This disqualified them. So with Joseph, formerly Jacob's favorite, now thought to be dead, Judah, fourth in line, must have seen himself as that person who would soon become the leader of the tribes of Israel. Judah, by agreeing to accept all blame if something were to happen to Benjamin, had much to lose. He too could have been disinherited. Jacob knew that too, and must have felt that if it were at all possible for Benjamin to be spared, Judah would do all that could be humanly done to see to it. Finally, here was a son who could be trusted. Jacob could trust Judah in this matter. But even more, Jacob would trust God. If he was to lose all of his sons, then so be it. It's in God's hands. So taking the money that had mysteriously found its way back into their grain bags upon their return from their first trip, and an equal amount now to buy new grain, the brothers, including Benjamin, journey back down to Egypt. Joseph sees that his brothers have returned. With them is Benjamin, so he orders a banquet to be prepared and served at noon. He orders his servants to bring his brothers inside his house for this banquet. But the brothers think, this is a trap. They're going to be taken as slaves, as they had arranged to happen to Joseph in retribution for the incident with this money that was found in their packs. Joseph's house manager assures him that is not the case. Joseph arrives at his home. His brothers are present. His brothers are present, and then they present him with these gifts they had brought with them from Canaan. Joseph inquires about his father's well-being. They don't understand it's about his father. They think it's about their father. And they tell him he's fine. But then Joseph spots Benjamin. He's just so overwhelmed with emotion. And he has to leave them for a few moments to weep bittersweet tears in private. Now, composed, Joseph returns, the meal is served. And what we see in these verses is a completely accurate account of the way that a meal of this sort would have been served in Egypt. Joseph eats alone. The brothers eat together as a group, and the Egyptian house servants eat separately from both the brothers and from Joseph. It's a well-documented Egyptian custom that the head of the house never eats with the servants. But why didn't the servants eat with the Israelite brothers? Well, we're told in verse 32 that it was aberrant to Egyptians to eat with Hebrews. That's why. See, this is interesting stuff. The Hebrews, as were many Semite tribes and people groups in this era, shepherds. The Egyptians saw shepherds as the lowest class of people, and their mere presence was offensive to them. An Egyptian would never eat with a shepherd. Egyptians valued cattle, not sheep. That's one of the reasons that the Egyptians' highest deity, Isis, was represented by a bull. But soon, another aspect of this Egyptian tradition was going to come into play. The Israelites were going to be given the land of Goshen to live in, a land where they would be away from the bulk of Egyptian society so they could grow their sheep and shepherd them and not offend Egyptian sensibilities. And as the brothers sat down to eat, each carefully seated by a servant in a place reserved specifically for each brother, they were stunned to see that they had been arranged from oldest to youngest in perfect order of their birth. What could this mean? Even more, Benjamin was given a food portion 5 times. Everyone else's scholars have debated the meaning of this fivefold blessing of food upon Benjamin. And the general consensus is that in Egypt, a prince or a ruler was given 5 times as much as everyone else as a sign of royalty. Of course, that also raises the question, what was Joseph signifying with this? My personal opinion is that Joseph was honoring the brother that he had the most affinity to because they shared a common mother. And the one who of the 11 brothers was completely innocent was Benjamin. He was innocent of any wrongdoing in connection with Joseph being sold into slavery. But we also should not overlook this. The first king of Israel would be a descendant of Benjamin's. We'll continue with our story of Joseph in Egypt next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.